Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing and how you can improve your arteries. Then we're going to segue into all those well baby visits that are expected of every parent. New information from the University of Iowa, 700,000 flu-like illnesses are linked to those visits. That's not good. Also, making more rational decisions following mindfulness meditation. A study showing that rhodiola improves hyperglycemia, and a lot of people have that. And we want to improve Alzheimer's conditions. So I'll tell you all about a new approach that is getting some really good results. Also, loneliness is a major health risk for people in the United States. And years after bullying, negative impact on a child's health may remain. What can we do about that? And more. Then from our environmental segment, a new report out this morning from Medical News Today showing that industrial chemicals, quote, may cause a global neurodevelopmental epidemic. This is in the peer-reviewed journal, The Lancet Neurology. It comes from Harvard School of Public Health. I'll go into depth about lead, methylmercury, arsenic, polychlorinated biphenyls, toluene, and all these other chemicals that are everywhere and why we should be concerned about them and what we can do about them. Also, from our environmental segment today, we're going to take an in-depth look, a little longer than we would normally spend, on the new Dust Bowl. California, it's Central Valley. But hold on, isn't that the same Central Valley that is supposed to be the breadbasket of America? Well, no, that's Kansas and Indiana and Illinois. This is the vegetable basket. This is where we grow our vegetables. But they're both under siege because of lack of water and severe drought and then severe winter. The new Dust Bowls, they're called epical, and that's important that we know that. Also today, we're going to do a commentary from Chris Hedges, and it will be entitled Our Sinister Dual State from Truth Dig. Then following that up, if time permits, we're going to look at shady ways the big pharma is corrupting your doctor. Then before anyone, especially the corporate Democrats, go forward in promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Atlantic Partnership, both of which would destroy our environment, our rights, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights, all shredded, and the President is fully aware of this, shouldn't we take a look back at NAFTA? We will. 20 years after NAFTA, what happened? We know what we were promised. What happened? And I don't know if I'll get to it today, if not on my next program. I was listening yesterday as I was going to see a friend that had just been in an art gallery and had an art showing. And I had on the radio, and I was hearing a person talk about why people are poor. It's really their fault. Of course, they're lazy. They don't work hard enough. They just want to be a part of a welfare state. Really? Well, I'm going to give you 20 things the poor really do every day from the Huffington Post. It'll show you that, no, they're not lazy, and they're not looking for welfare. Not that some aren't. Of course, some people are always looking to hustle the system, but the wealthiest are the best at hustling the system. Corporate welfare. So as you see, we have that plus. We won't have a guest today. Instead, I'm going to play you a short piece of a woman who stood up to the U.S. government, the FBI, the IRS, and took them on under oath in Congress. You won't want to miss this. You're not. You haven't heard this. You haven't seen it. Boy, I'm glad that there are such courageous people in our society who finally take them on and are not afraid. Let's begin. Soy is a very important product. For decades, it has been in the United States for centuries. It has been in the Far East, in Japan, India, Korea, Indonesia. Now, there are two types of soy. There's the natural soy that is not genetically engineered, that is organically grown, that is used in its various forms, such as tofu or tempeh or misos and natto. And then there is the genetically engineered soy, primarily used to feed cattle and pigs and even fish. And that is a big problem, not only because it is genetically engineered, but because the land that they use to grow it on, more often than not, in South America, means the destruction of the rainforest. And that, in turn, adversely affects great places that have once been teeming with diversity of species and humans. Now, it's becoming desertified. And also, if you trace the Amazon, the great Amazon, you'll find that villages that used to be on the Amazon are now back hundreds of meters because the Amazon is shrinking. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that you take away the trees that act as not just the carbon sinks, but also hold in the water. An average tree can hold in this anywhere between 10 to 25,000 gallons of water. So there's a lot about soy, pro and con. There are those who believe that soy should not be used, and then that there are those of us, myself included, who believe that organic soil, as a part of an overall healthy diet, not exclusive or not dominant, is very important. We have over 5,400 studies showing its health benefits. Here's the latest. This is in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nutrition, Metabolism, and Cardiovascular Disease. They looked at 17 separate studies, and they looked at the isoflavones. These are parts of the soy, and they wanted to see, will these benefit the endothelium? Now, the endothelium, of course, is the lining that helps us have healthy blood flow, get nutrients from the bloodstream into the tissue, to the cell. So they found that supplementing with soy isoflavones can improve blood vessel endothelial function and reduce cardiovascular disease factors. And that's a big deal. Quote, cumulative evidence from the randomized controlled trials included in this meta-analysis suggests that exposure to soy isoflavones can modestly but significantly improve endothelial function as measured by blood mediation dilation, end quote. Why is this important? Because about a fourth of the American population are at risk of heart disease of one form or another. Soy foods have been shown to reduce cholesterol levels, and that's because of the isoflavones, and reduce cardiovascular disease. So when you reduce blood pressure, reduce cholesterol, improve endothelial function, you're saving a life. Keep in mind, cardiovascular disease affects 1 in 3 Americans, adults, and is a leading cause of death worldwide. And when you have any form of endothelial dysfunction, that's a big red flag that says you have the early stages of heart disease and it's predictive of your death. So you can't take this stuff lightly. You have to look at it. We must pay attention to what's going on inside of our bodies. And this is a good thing, and it's good information, so we can live a longer and healthier life. It's just routine for mothers to take their children in for what is called a well child visit. Think again before you do that. This is from the University of Iowa. Quote, new research shows that well-child doctor appointments for annual exams and vaccinations are associated with an increased risk of flu-like illnesses in children and family members within 2 weeks of the visit. It translates to more than 700,000 potentially avoidable illnesses each year, costing over $490 million per year. And this was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology. That's the Journal of the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America. So, what part of that is bad? The visit to the doctor? No. The doctor giving your child an examination? No, that's fine. It's the vaccines. That's what's doing it. And remember, once a child is at home with those vaccines, they're shedding frequently the viruses in their saliva, and parents come in contact with that. We should all be making rational decisions in life. More often than not, we don't. Even very wise people, even very well-educated people, will frequently make wrong choices. And there's a lot of mitigating circumstances behind it. It's not one thing. But here's one thing that can improve your chance of making a rational decision. Meditation. Mindfulness meditation. From the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, published in the peer-reviewed journal Psychological Science. Quote, one 15-minute focused breathing meditation may help people make smarter choices. People have trouble acknowledging their failures, limitations, in effect cutting their losses. We as human beings hold on to a losing stock for too long. We stay in bad relationships too long. We continue to eat large restaurant meals even when we're full. I've seen in my travels, I've seen people at all-you-can-eat buffets where they've had one or two plates and go back for a third, and I'm sitting right behind them, and I'm hearing them say, yeah, but it's for $9.95, I'm going to pack as much in as I can. By the way, what I do is I always take a cooler with those foods that I want to eat, and like, you know, organic potatoes and rice and beans, and I'll go into a restaurant, and I'll look for the menu, that most expensive item, which is generally $15, maybe $20. And I'll ask the manager, I said, I'm on a special diet. I'm willing to pay for your most expensive meal. And could you have your chef cook these items for me? And with rare exception, they say, fine. You know, they just made all profit. They had no cost, and just the time of the chef cooking something, so at least I get, you know, something I can eat. It looks a little strange. I'm sure they've never had it happen before. But for me, it just works fine. So any of the others out there listening, it's something you could consider for yourself. But it's what you see people eating. I've seen people eat cheesecakes, an entire cheesecake, because, as one person argued, hey, that's going to cost me $15. I'm getting all I can eat for $9.95, so I'm going to eat that whole cake. And indeed, he ate the whole cake. Of course, he was overweight. So we have to understand that we're always making wrong choices. And yet, if you ask, okay, here's what we're going to do. You bought this new car. Good. I would like for you to drive at the speed limit, you know, 45 or 55 miles an hour, but blindfolded down the street. You don't mind doing that? Well, of course I'm not going to drive blindfolded. Why? Why would you mind being blindfolded? Well, I'm going to wreck. I'm going to hurt someone, hurt myself, kill someone, kill myself. So why can't you use that same sense of protecting yourself when it comes to the other selections in your life? And then you start to see how we make wrong choices. You've all heard the notion throwing good money after bad. It is what is known in behavioral sciences as the sunk cost bias. Most people have trouble admitting they were wrong when their initial decisions lead to undesirable outcomes. And that is, they don't want to feel wasteful or that their initial investment was a loss. Ironically, this kind of thinking often causes people to waste or lose more resources in an attempt to regain their initial investment or to try to break even. Now, across a series of studies, the authors of Mindful Meditation found that when you are meditating mindfully, you cultivate a greater awareness of the present moment, and that clears the mind of other thoughts. And that can help to counteract these deep-rooted biases. From the study, University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, quote, we found that a brief period of mindfulness meditation can encourage people to make more rational decisions by considering the information available in the present moment, while ignoring some of the other concerns that typically exacerbate the sunk cost bias. So that's good. So it just means that if we gave ourselves an opportunity each day for 15 minutes, just to get it into a quiet place, no distractions, and just sit quietly and breathe deeply and relax, and just allow ourselves to be in the moment. Now, it frequently helps if you're in a museum and looking at a beautiful piece of artwork, and just stay transfixed on that artwork. Or if you're sitting, like I frequently do, in after my radio show in New York City, I'll walk out to Riverside Park or Central Park and just sit, looking out over the Hudson River. It's just very peaceful and mindful. And then you just become one with that moment. That's when you're able then, through that mindfulness, to regain a sense of the rationale, what choices you ideally should be making. It is one good way to clear your mind. I also found a way of doing it when I'm exercising. Now, I'm doing some really long-distance training. Yesterday, I trained 20 miles, plus then did 2 hours in the gym for a national championship coming up this week. And when I'm working out, I'm focused on my breathing, deep diaphragmatic breathing, relaxing the body, and then I take one problem at a time, and I put it in my mind, and I put it in front of me. And I'm saying, what would be the best choice I could make with this problem? And then I could say, what would be the worst choice I could make with this problem? And what would be the outcome of each? So you look at the outcome of making the best choice. You look at the outcome of making the worst choice. And then in that mindfulness, almost always you'll make the right choice. Having the courage to follow through on it, getting past insecurity and fear, that's a separate story. But at least you know what your right choice could be. A lot of people finally get to where they know what the right choice in life is, but they don't have the motivation. They're not in the right place frequently in their life, and they have a lot of conditioning that is going to constantly be telling them no. Don't take that risk. Don't take that chance. Don't take that opportunity. You know, stay where you're at. And then it depends upon the person's determination and the strength of their character is the choice they make. But mindfulness meditation gets you there. Now, coming in the same dynamic is a University of California, Berkeley study, and it's about stress and how it makes your brain more susceptible to mental illness. Quote, experts already know that people suffering from chronic stress are prone to experiencing mental health problems, such as anxiety, and mood disorders later in life. Now a new study from research at the University of California, Berkeley explained why. Now here's what it is. Previous research has shown that people with post-traumatic stress disorder and other stress-related conditions have abnormalities. And that is because every time you're stressed, you end up adversely affecting the brain. And that is a challenge. You create oxidative stress, and you end up with an imbalance of white matter in the brain, and while matter gets its name from the white fatty sheath of myelin coating it, the electrically insulated layer that forms around nerves and accelerates the transmission of electrical signals between cells. The new study focused on cells in the brain that produce myelin, an electronically insulated layer that forms around nerves, and they found that when you're stressed, you're depressed, you're anxious, you're insecure, you're rageful, you're really destroying your brain. You're reducing the myelin. You're adversely affecting the white matter. You're adversely affecting the formation of synapses, the structures that allow nerve cells to connect and exchange information with each other. So you're really playing havoc with your brain. So one more reason to choose B, de-stressing. We have a lot of people suffering from blood sugar imbalances, and one new study shows that rhodiola, R-H-O-D, iola, I-O-L-A, improves blood sugar levels, and this was with diabetes. So it's very important, and it's an adaptogen, and it helps with blood glucose in the body. So if you're a pre-diabetic, a diabetic suffering from hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia, look at this it could help you. And speaking of looking at something that helped people, there's new research that was done on neurodegenerative diseases, among them Alzheimer's, and they're finding that the higher the cholesterol, the more you're going to promote a problem in the brain, and therefore get your cholesterol under control, and therefore you help yourself with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. Also, loneliness is a major risk factor for older adults, and I'm finding that a lot of people are willing to talk with me, not because I'm doing this very important documentary on poverty, but because they're lonely. And when I sit and talk with them about their story, what their life was like, their relationships, and how it is today, they could spend several hours, and they're looking at you, and you're seeing a real human being who's suffering, and your heart goes out to them. You feel deep compassion, because you know that when you fold up the camera and you put your gear away and you get in the car and you look back, there's a person who's going to be right back at their loneliness, feeling helpless because they have no advocates. And they don't have anyone paying attention to them. They're not walking on red carpet. They're not having a baby, and it's in the headlines because of why? The person's a celebrity? Their world is shrinking. This is from the University of Chicago. Quote, feeling extreme loneliness can increase an older person's chance of premature death by 14%. That's really significant. So what can we do about that? I believe that there's several things. First, you should be in warmer climates. That's a very, very good thing to do. Because if you're going to be depressed, do you want to be depressed where it's cold and you're freezing your butt off, or where it's warm? Because the sun itself provides you with a vitamin D3, and that can help your mood also. Next, when you're in a cold place, you generally are restricted to how much activity you can do outside. When you're in a warm place, you're not restricted. You can go to the beach. You can get into communities. And I believe that you should be looking for communities of like-minded people and share in that. And there are people of all economic strata who can then be your new best friends, make new friends. You know, if you're up in Wisconsin, you're in Buffalo, you're looking outside, you're hearing the wind, how the snow come up against the side of the house, you can't go out any place, your utility bills are through the roof, the phone's not ringing, you don't have a social network as such. Why be there? Get out of there. I don't believe people should be living in most of the states in America, in most of the places. Why in the hell would anyone want to live in Buffalo? I'm sure that there are some people who will justify it, fine. But reasonableness? No. Be rational. Live where there's community, weather, environment, and opportunity. And that's what we have to be doing. And I believe that we'll have more and more opportunity, especially for the baby boomers, because they're not as stuck up on staying forever in this house because, you know, it's always been in the family. Yeah, but the family's gone, and you're all alone, and it's not a happy place anymore. It was, it's not. Things change. Let's change with it. And I think that's crucial. Finally, citrus can ward off strokes. This is from a major university teaching hospital in France. It says, quote, eating foods that contain vitamin C may reduce your risk of the most common type of a stroke. And this was presented at the American Academy of Neurology's annual meeting. Now, we know that vitamin C from papaya and peppers and broccoli and oranges and strawberries are important. We also know that stroke is the third major killer or second major killer in the United States. And we know that we're not getting enough vitamin C. So get more citrus, have more vitamin C, supplement with vitamin C, and cut your risk of having a stroke. And by the way, for those of you who were bullied in the workplace and relationships early in life, from Boston Children's Hospital, long-term study shows negative compounding effects of bullying. The longer the period of time a child is bullied, the more severe the lasting impact on a child's health. This is according to the current peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics. The study is the first to examine the compounding effects of bullying from elementary school to high school. Quote, our research shows that long-term bullying has a severe impact on a child's overall health and that its negative effects can accumulate and get worse with time, even after the bullying has stopped or the person's moved away. So one of the things I suggest there is to first get some humanistic, holistic psychological counseling. Secondly, is we cannot change what has been in our background, but we can certainly change how we're going to respond to it. The trouble is, up until the time we get some help, we're responding the same way every day, and it's almost always a reaction. And we keep bringing ourselves back to being a victim, and hence we master the story of our victimization. So if anyone asks us, we can tell them incredibly detailed and emotionally strung together story about how we were victimized, and that's why we're overweight, or that's why we're this or that. That's why we end up in abusive relationships, because we were abused. And you've got to change the story if you want to change your life. You cannot change your life without changing your story. Your story is your perception. You sell your perception, you believe in your perception, and your perception becomes your reality. So if you want to have a new reality, if you want to have a new chapter, if you want to have a new day, if you want to have a new anything, then you've got to change the chapter that you've been reading from and write a new one. One where you're in control, where you're loved and appreciated and respected, where you only have people in your life that love and respect and appreciate you, where you only associate with people where something positive can come from it, where you're around optimists, not pessimists, where you're around people who can do instead of can't do, where you're around people who say yes instead of no. That's what you need to do. It's that simple. It's not complicated. We make something extremely complicated that shouldn't be. And then every day reaffirm your right to be happy and healthy. And then one day, you're rewarded with the long-term benefits of all the good choices you've made, emotionally, spiritually, physically. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. And I'm going to play, when we come back, a under oath testimony of just a regular American woman who was harassed by the federal government with all of its resources. And instead of buckling, she fought back. We'll hear from her in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Noll. I'd like to thank you for listening all over. We're syndicated all over the world. Tonight at 8 p.m., following the Progressive Commentary Hour, which is at 7, we're going to have a one-hour discussion on the future of Pacifica and BAI and all the different issues that are involved. You won't want to miss that. Please tune in tonight at 8 p.m. Now, let's take a few minutes and hear what a woman has to say about our government and what amounts to fascism in the United States.
After all the tyranny and all the things that have been done to my organizations, to my family, and to me, many people would quit, and Mr. Chairman, many Americans have quit. I've heard over and over that people are afraid to tell their stories. But know this. My experience at the hands of this government in the last 5 years have made me more determined ever than before to stand before you and to all of America and say that I will not retreat, I will not surrender, I will not be intimidated, and I will not ask for permission to exercise my constitutional rights. But once I helped found Through the Vote and King Street Patriots, I found myself a target of this federal government. Shortly after filing IRS forms to establish 501c3 and C4 tax-exempt organizations, an assortment of federal entities, including law enforcement agencies and Congressman Cummings, came knocking at my door. In nearly two decades of running our small business, my husband and I never dealt with any government agency outside of filing our annual tax returns. We'd never been audited. We'd never been investigated. But all that changed upon submitting applications for the nonprofit statuses of True the Vote and King Street. Since that filing in 2010, my private businesses, my nonprofit organizations, my family, and I have been subjected to more than 15 instances of audit or inquiry by federal agencies. In 2011, my personal and business tax returns were audited by the Internal Revenue Service, each audit going back for a number of years. In 2012, my business was subjected to inspection by OSHA on a select occasion when neither my husband or I were present, and though the agency wrote that it found nothing serious or significant, it still issued fines in excess of $20,000. In 2012 and again in 2013, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms conducted comprehensive audits at my place of business, and beginning in 2010, the FBI contacted my nonprofit organization on six separate occasions, wanting to call through membership manifests in conjunction with domestic terrorism cases. They eventually dropped all matters and have now redacted nearly all my files. All of these incursions into my affairs began after filing applications for tax exemption. There is no other remarkable event. There's no other reason to explain how, for decades, I went unnoticed, but now find myself on the receiving end of interagency coordination into and against all facets of my life, both personal and private. Bear in mind, distinguished ladies and gentlemen of this subcommittee, these events were occurring while the IRS was subjecting me to multiple rounds of abusive inquiries with requests to provide every Facebook and Twitter I'd ever posted, questions about my political aspirations and demands to know the names of groups that I'd spoken with, the content of what I'd said, and everywhere I intended to speak in the coming year. The answers to these sorts of questions are not of interest to the typical IRS analyst, but they are certainly of interest to a political machine that would put its own survival against the civil liberties of a private citizen. This government attacked me because of my political beliefs, but I refuse to be cast as a victim. Not to the IRS, not to the FBI, not to OSHA, not to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or to any other government agency, I am not a victim, because a victim has no options. I do have options, and I intend to use them to the fullest extent of my capabilities. As an American citizen, I am part of a country that still believes in freedom of speech, and so I will continue to speak out. Here in Congress and all across this country, I will continue to press in every legal way possible, as I did by filing suit against the Internal Revenue Service. No American citizen should be willing to accept a government that uses its power against its own people.
Good for her. I wish we had many more like her willing to stand up and take on these corrupt institutions. This is from Chris Hedges. It is entitled Our Sinister Dual State. It is published on truthdig.com, and of course, every day, 7 days a week, we have between 30 to 70 articles from progressive individuals in all fields on our own site. On Thursday, the former National Security Agency official and whistleblower, William E. Benny, and I will debate Stuart A. Baker, former general counsel for the National Security Agency, P.J. Crowley, a former State Department spokesman, and a media pundit, Jeffrey Tobin. The debate at Oxford University will center on whether Edward Snowden's leaks helped or harmed the public good. The proposition asks, is Edward Snowden a hero? But on a deeper level, the debate will revolve around our nation's loss of liberty. This audience knows that I've been doing a series for the past 5 years on the encroachment of the federal government upon states' rights, and I support states' rights more than I do federal. It is approached the point where we as citizens no longer have privacy, and in effect we are wards of the state. And I continue to bring this to you. Well, the government officials who, along with their Their spokespersons in the press castigate Snowden, insist that congressional and judicial oversight, the right to privacy, the rule of law, freedom of the press, and the right to express dissent remain inviolate. They use the old words and old phrases, old laws and old constitutional guarantees to give our corporate totalitarianism a democratic veneer. They insist that the system works. They tell us we are all still protected by the Fourth Amendment. Quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon the probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing a place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, end quote. Yet the promise of that sentence in the Bill of Rights is pitted against the fact that every telephone call we make, every email or text we send or receive, every website we visit, and many of our travels are tracked, recorded, and stored in government computers. The Fourth Amendment was written in 1789 in direct response to the arbitrary and unchecked search powers that the British had exercised through general warrants called writs of assistance, which played a significant part in fomenting the American Revolution. A technical system of surveillance designed to monitor those considered to be a danger to the state has, in the words of Biney, been turned against you. We live in what the German politician scientist Ernst Frankel called the dual state. Totalitarian states are always dual states. In the dual state, civil liberties are abolished in the name of national security. The political sphere becomes a vacuum, and there are no legal checks on power. Official bodies operate with impunity outside the law. In the dual state, the government can convict citizens on secret evidence in secret courts. It can strip citizens of due process and detain, torture, or assassinate them, serving as judge, jury, and executioner. It rules according to its own arbitrary whims and prerogatives. The outward forms of democratic participation, meaning voting and competing political parties and judicial oversight and legislation, are hollow, political stagecraft. And that's where these people are able to be held in check, the people. The masses in a totalitarian structure live in the term the normative state. The normative state is defenseless against the abuses of the prerogative state. Citizens are subjected to draconian laws and regulations, as well as arbitrary searches and arrests. The police and internal security are omnipotent. The internal workings of power are secret. Free expression and oppression of political activity are pushed to the fringes of society or shut down. Those who challenge the abuses of power by the prerogative state, those who, like Snowden, expose the crimes carried out by government, are made into criminals. Totalitarian states always invert the moral order. It is the wicked who rule. It is the just who are damned. Snowden, we are told, could have reformed from the inside. He could have gone to his superiors or Congress or the courts. But Snowden had numerous examples, including the persecution of the whistleblower Thomas Drake, who originally tried to go through so-called proper channels to remind him that working within the system is fatal. He had watched as senior officials, including Barack Obama, lied to the public about internal surveillance. He knew that the president was dishonest when he assured Americans that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which meets in secret and hears only from the government, is transparent. He knew that the president's statement that Congress was overseeing the entire program was a lie. He knew that everything Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told the press, the Congress, and the public about the surveillance of Americans was also a lie. And he knew that as this information was to be made available to the public, he would have to do so through the few journalists whose integrity he could trust. I was a plaintiff before the Supreme Court in Clapper versus Amnesty International, which challenged the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. This act authorizes surveillance without a showing or probable cause that a targeted person is an agent of a foreign power. The court dismissed our lawsuit because it said the idea that we were targets of surveillance was, quote, based too much on speculation. The Supreme Court ruling was then used by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals to deny the credibility or standing of the other plaintiffs, me and others, and as a result, it was dismissed. The government in both court cases did not attempt to defend the surveillance and detention programs as constitutional. It instead said that I and the other plaintiffs had no right to bring the case to court, and the courts agreed. This deadly impasse, the tightening of the corporate totalitarian noose, would have continued if Snowden had not jolted the nation awake by disclosing the crimes of the prerogative state. Snowden's revelations triggered, for the first time, a genuine public debate about mass surveillance. Since the disclosures, three judges have ruled on the National Security Agency surveillance program, one defending it as legal and two accusing the National Security Agency of violating the Constitution. A presidential panel has criticized the agency's blanket surveillance and called for reform. Some members of Congress, although that body authorized the Patriot Act and its Section 215, which ostensibly permitted this wholesale surveillance of the public, have expressed dismay at the extent of the National Security Agency's activities and the weakness of its promised reforms. Maybe they are lying. Maybe they're not. Maybe reforms will produce improvements, or maybe they will merely be cosmetic. But before Snowden, we had nothing. Snowden's revelations made us conscious. And as George Orwell wrote in his dystopian novel, 1984, until they become conscious, they will never rebel. Now we're all familiar with Congress's most dramatic oversight failures, said Ben Wisner, director of the American Civil Liberties Union speech. And he is not alone. Societies that once had democratic traditions or periods when openness was possible are often seduced into totalitarian systems because those who rule continue to pay outward attention to the ideals, practices, and forms of the old systems. But it's only a mouthwork. This was true when the Emperor Augustus dismantled the Roman Republic. It was true when Lenin and the Bolsheviks seized control of the autonomous Soviets and ruthlessly centralized power. It was true following the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazi fascism. Thomas Paine described despotic government as a fungus growing out of a corrupt civil society. And this is what has happened to us. No one who lives under the constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere at any time, whose conversations, messages, meetings, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can ever be described as free. The relationship between the United States government and its citizens is now one of master and slave. Yet the prerogative state assures us that our rights are sacred, that it abides by the will of the people and the consent of the governed. The defense of liberty, which Snowden exhibited when he cast his fortune, his safety, and his life aside to inform the public of the forces arrayed against constitutional rights, entails grave risks in dual states. It demands personal sacrifice. And I would agree with that. And you'll have a chance now to share your points of view after we go for one more piece here. And this piece is about our environment. This is from Alan Nick in Mendota, California, The Telegraph in the United Kingdom. Quote, the new Dust Bowl, apical drought hits California Central Valley. On the road into the small California farming community of Mendota, the sign reads, Stop, Dust Bowl. And another sign says, Save Water. As farmers in orchards are busy bulldozing withered almond trees, it didn't used to be like this here. Until recently, the town of 11,000 people was proudly known as the cantaloupe capital of the world. Of all the many local crops, its melons were most prized. Mendota's farmers have been growing them since the 1920s, when Greek immigrants arrived and found the soil was perfect. The lush fields used to provide 70% of America's cantaloupes. But today, Mendota is becoming known as another place, sitting at ground zero in an unfolding, slow-motion, billion-dollar disaster, what climatologists are calling an epical drought. Analysts of the rings and the ancient trees suggest that the region is experiencing a lack of rain not seen since 1580, around the time of Sir Francis Drake when he reached the California coast and claimed it for Elizabeth I. In a neat modern town hall built in the good times, Mendota Mayor Robert Silva shakes his head ruefully as he looks at the latest unemployment figures. It stands at 34% and will top 50% as farmers leave more fields fallow in the next few months. Quote, "We will soon have the highest unemployment rate in America. Things are really not good," he says. "There are going to be a lot of dust flying around all over the place here. On the streets outside, workers in cowboy hats loll on benches under a baking sun, not a cloud or a job in sight. Times are so bad that 99-cent stores has competition from a 98-cent store, and people are queuing up for donated clothes at the youth center. Similar scenes are evident in towns up and down California's Central Valley. The scale of the drought is staggering. The Central Valley is known as the breadbasket of America and covers a vast area half the size of England. It produces 50% of the fruit and vegetables in the United States. For several years, the resolute Mr. Silva has been writing to the White House pleading for help, but to no avail. And that's part of it. So it's bad, going to get worse, and that's unfortunate. But I've been bringing this to your attention in detail for many years. Let me explain. It is only going to get worse. The rationing will become mandatory. You're not going to have lawns. You're not going to have water for your cars. Municipal swimming pools are gone. And listen carefully what I'm going to tell you now. From Arizona to Nevada to New Mexico to Utah to California to much of Texas, look in the next 2 years at your golf courses not being allowed to water their lawns and hence dust bowls. I'm telling you this now. Mark my words, it's going to happen. So you better be looking for a place that is sustainable, because the places I've just mentioned, including Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma, are not. There's just not the water there, and there's going to be severe drought. With that comes windstorms in the really the bad Southwest, sandstorms. So you're going to have dust storms with wind, and you're going to have sandstorms with wind. Dust is choking, it clogs everything. Sand can do a lot of damage. That's what's coming. I wished it were otherwise. The good news is, try to relocate to more sustainable environments. Now time for Talk Back, your opportunity to call in and share your comments, thoughts, points of view, questions. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 is our number to call in. That's 888-874-4888. And for those of you who've been listening over the telephone, always keep that number you can call and listen live over the telephone. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. And while my engineer in New York is going to get the people up on the line, I have something I've never offered before. Is a fundraiser, and I thought this would be fun. So I'm looking forward to being back in the city next week. We're going to do this for a contribution of $500, $500, but if you're a couple, it's $400 each. You're going to have dinner at a gourmet vegetarian restaurant with me. Then I'm going to take you downtown to a Broadway show. So we're going to see a Broadway show, have dinner at a gourmet restaurant, bring you back uptown, and finish off with dessert, gourmet vegan dessert. All right, how about that for an evening? It's going to start at 6 and probably in between 11 and 12. A whole evening together. Now, on Democracy Now!, they give you some fair trade coffee. You can watch a broadcast, and then they take you out someplace for a meal, and that's it. That's for $2,000. Here it's a Broadway show, gourmet vegetarian meal, cab fares included, I pay for that, and a dessert, all for $500 to support this important station. All right? A couple, you get $200 off. So it's a great deal, and one of the things I love doing is I love going to Broadway. London and New York have the finest plays I've seen in the world, and I generally go two nights a week. And what's nice is if, you know, you'll have a chance to select the night you want to go, or a weekend, Sunday night, Saturday night, weekdays, and it's going to start mid-March. So here's, if you want to join and at the same time support this station and all of its good work, then call this number now. I'm going to give you a number to call, and when we're filled, we're filled. Now, there'll be some time when there'll just be one person or a couple of myself. That's it. Another time there might be a group, and we'll try to get, like, you know, what you like best, because I'm going to be here, and I'm going to make myself available to the station and to you for what should be a great, great time. All right? So I'm going to give you the number. Write it down and call now. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. An evening out. Gourmet vegan dinner. A Broadway show, and a gourmet vegan dessert back uptown. How about that? For $500 for a single person, or $400 per person for a couple, you can't beat that. All right? Never done it before. Last year, we did a dinner at a restaurant downtown as a fundraiser for BAI, and we had, I think, about 70 people, and they paid, I think it was $250 or $300. And that was just for a dinner. And I told him I don't want that many people. So this is we're going to try to limit it to only a couple of people per night, or even just one person per night. So people have, you know, it's not a bunch of people. So that's what we're going to do. All right? So going to only do it once. We're going to start it mid-March. It'll probably take 2 weeks to get through all of it, and it's just going to be a great time. 877-627-5065. All right. If the phone is busy, and I'm just told right now the phone's busy, because they have a number, and when we reach number, there's no more. It's going to be loud. Because I don't want, you know, to me, the ideal would be 2 to 4 people. That would be ideal per night. That way everybody has a chance to chat and talk and share thoughts and see some great Broadway plays. And you'll have a chance to select. We'll look to see which plays that week people want to see and try to select some real good ones. All right. And it doesn't matter what the play costs, even if it's expensive, it's still you won't be charged anymore. I just went to, what did I see before I left? I saw Motown. I think that was $220 a person. So we won't be doing that, but I just looked yesterday in the paper, and there were 28 plays I have not seen and on Broadway and about 20 off Broadway. It'll be a great evening. But again, if it's busy right now, please call back. When we reach our quota, that's it. An evening, gourmet vegan meal, Broadway show, and gourmet vegan dessert. 877-627-5065. Now let's go to the phones and say hello to the people we have. Let's say hello to, who do we have here? Eric from New Jersey. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Good.
Fantastic. Wanted to just run this by you. Did you have a chance to review a most recent book that just was released, I guess, last month or so, by Dr. David Perlmutter, called Grain Brain?
Yes, and here's my thoughts. I know David, and I know him very well. In fact, I had filmed him for a couple of the films I've done. He is correct. Absolutely correct when talking about the type of grains that we consume, the amount of grains we consume, and the impact of those gluten and highly allergenic and processed empty calories upon our brain and body. I had already written about this in the Food Mood Connection 10 years before this and did a PBS special on it as well. But when you're talking about whole grains, organic, unsprayed, as a part of the diet, it's a completely different story. And I have worked with over 40,000 people in health support clinical studies where they've been given a whole food diet, and whole unprocessed grains are a part of that, such as brown rice instead of white rice, and quinoa, red quinoa, for example, and whole millet, and then bringing in the beans and the legumes and pulses and the root vegetables, and that is the healthy diet. But if you're talking about the average diet and the processing of that diet, he's absolutely correct. But I'm talking about whole diet. All the best to you. John from Long Island. Hi, John. John, your turn.
Yes, Gary. Gary, my comment's going to be on goal. Before I talk about that, I caught your video yesterday on YouTube, organic farming video,
yes,
which was tremendous. Unbelievable, the insight of planting to prepping the soil, the harvesting of the outside of the leaves to protecting with the garlic oil. I just recommend that to all the listeners. I just found it very informative.
Thank you.
Okay, my comment on gold, I was very pro-gold. I wanted to call you about a month ago, and I know you have Gerald Celente on, and it's really, I'm pro-gold, more the physical on the gold and the silver, and it's more of an anti-banking and stock market point of view. But I just wanted to give you this fact on gold, that in 1970, I found this chart that 1 ounce of gold, the purchasing power, would buy 20 gallons of milk. The dollar at the time, you'd be able to purchase 3/4 of a gallon of milk. When you fast forward to 2012, that same 1 ounce of gold was now, you were able to purchase over 400 gallons of milk compared to the $1, which would get you a quart of milk. And I just wanted to share that with your audience.
I appreciate those insights. I will be doing a special 1 hour Monday night Progressive Commentary Hour on how gold has been manipulated, silver manipulated, currency markets manipulated by the Federal Reserve and the major banks, and that if we had allowed gold and silver to reach their normal and natural highs, we'd be at about $3,000 an ounce for gold and about $50 for silver. I believe that when the crash comes, and it's inevitable that it will come, because the housing market has been artificially supported, a bubble, by those speculators buying large tracts of houses. They're going to start selling those over the next 2 years. The average person has not been buying houses. We have not seen an improvement in the life, the quality of life, the savings, nor the income in quality in the average person. Hence all the other figures that would have to be there for a housing market, someone to go out and buy a market, have been inflated by these people. So that's going to crash. China and other currencies will become the dominant currency. We'll lose the position of the world reserve currency, and the dollar will hit hyperinflation and probably 20% of its value gone. And that's going to happen, I believe, in the next 2 years. I wish it didn't, but it's going to. So then you'll see the price of gold and silver, not certificates. Never buy a certificate. Take actual possession of gold and never put it in a bank. In fact, I don't believe we should be having our money in banks unless it's a credit union. Then you'll see the real value of it. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Let's say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann. Luann Panessi, the holistic nurse.
Hello, Gary. Well, I have some more sad news about the impact of the weather and the environment. It was just reported that we have a national clown shortage. It may be approaching. But with a little homework, we found out that all of the clowns were hired by MSNBC, and only the stage makeup has changed, and the rest are in Congress. So we really don't have a clown shortage. But the circuses are concerned because they have a clown shortage. Anyway, I have an email here from Linda, and she said that she hears that you're training to race next week in national championships. She says, my dad raced against you in Washington, D.C. in 1993 in the 20K. That's where we live. He remembers that all these Olympians were in this one pack, and you were like 100 yards behind them. And you ended up being the first masters. You came in first and set a record. Then there were the 10 relays, 10Ks, and once again, you passed young athletes that were the top in the field. You were right behind them in the race. You blew the whole field away. In fact, you lapped my dad and other top athletes. My dad said that you were simply unbeatable and that you were winning every single race you were in. And here's my question for you. She said, my dad stopped racing 15 years ago and even stopped following the sport. Do you always continue? Do you ever burn out? Do you ever take breaks? That's her question.
I take breaks, but I don't stop. I went from racing as many as 40 races a year, mainly championships, to racing about 7 or 8. And now I'm getting ready for the World Games about a year and a half from now, and it requires about a year of prep. I believe that we have to be conscious of the true choices and the value of the choices we make. And when we begin to lose races or lose in our competition in sports, whatever it may be, we end up with some irrational fears. And fear of loss, fear of losing your income, fear of losing your standard of living, fear of losing your job, fear of losing your relationship, fear of losing your position within a field, motivates you to do stupid things. Think of all the artists who should have been wiser in the choices of their movie they wrote or produced or directed or acted in, the songs that they sang, the things that we do when we fear that if we're not constantly producing something, the public will forget us, that there'll be 1,000 of the people can take our place. And you see it in athletes when they begin to lose at a certain point. More often than not, it's not because they're better athletes coming up. It's just that they have stopped growing. And you have to frequently pull back, take a break, reevaluate what you have to do differently. Just doing more of the same won't work. You have to be wiser about your diet, about your chi. If you're giving your central chi, your basic life energy, to everything in your life, you're not going to have enough when it comes to racing. So you have to make priorities. You have to make some sacrifices. Then you go back into the sport and not competing against others. You're competing against yourself, from the old self to the new self. And that's why the older you get, the wiser you should become as an athlete. And you should always engage in athleticism, and that's important because it's a very good way of mastering our life. We have to understand that we don't master happiness. We only master the objects that are meant to give us happiness. So winning is supposed to give us happiness, but it doesn't. Physical things, a new car, a bigger home, you know, a prettier, more handsome companion, none of that gives us happiness. These are objects. What really matters is that you must define the real self versus the conditioned self. You must surrender the ego that manipulates you into dramas. You must align yourself with the right identity and stop with the mistaken identities. You have to validate your life by not conforming to life. And when you do that, then you're living a sustainable life, of which athleticism is a part of that. And that I'm happy to participate in. And yes, there was a time when I did a lot of over 600 races, and I never lost one, and I still haven't. And it doesn't mean that I'm a better athlete. It just means that I'm looking at what I can do to improve and change, and that's exciting because it means we're still growing, still learning, still aware. Thanks a lot for your call.
Sure.
I'm Gary Knoll. That brings up the end of this program, and I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And don't forget, tonight, 8 p.m., 7 o'clock is our progressive commentary hour, but 8 p.m. I'm going to have a discussion on the nature of Pacifica, WBAI, the listeners, myself, and its future. You won't want to miss that. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead, and I'm inviting Utrice to also be a part of that discussion tonight. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. We'll be there. Today we're talking about Florida versus Dunn, the Stand Your Ground trial in Jacksonville, Florida, that ended Saturday with a mistrial on the most serious charge of first-degree homicide. Michael Dunn, 47, was on trial for killing 17-year-old Jordan Davis in 2012. After a heated argument over loud music, Dunn said he feared for his life after he asked Davis to turn the music down.
We look forward to it. As always, insights that you can only get from this unique and enlightened person, Utrice Lead, right now.
Thank you.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me.